September coming to a close with some drama in the financial markets. In the last 24 hours, the 10-year yield above 1.5% for the first time since June. Brent crude above $80 a barrel for the first time since October 2018. Natural gas prices also soaring. The dollar index at its highest level since November 2020. U.S. home prices surging 19.7% in July. That's the 14th straight month of gains. On the flip side, consumer confidence down three straight months, and the stock market falling as we're talking here midday Tuesday. The NASDAQ's down 2.5%, rising yields, putting a pinch on technology stocks once again. So all this noise, what does it signify? Joining us to help sort that out is Jeff Kilberg, Chief Investment Officer of Sanctuary Wealth, which has about $19 billion of assets under management. Jeff is also the founder and CEO of KKM Financial. Jeff, welcome back to Alpha Trader.
Aaron, thanks for having me, bud. Always a pleasure.
So it's great to have you back here because there is so much going on seemingly right now in the financial markets. September has been a weak month for stocks, but you know, we're still not that far from all-time highs, but there's definitely a sense of nervousness and risk off out there. What do you, you know, this is a huge question, obviously, but what do you make of all this? Is this just noise or is something bigger happening here?
I think first and foremost, I think we need to just breathe. I think if we just breathe right now, we'll be able to digest all this. But let's remember all this volatility. And yes, you're right, Aaron. Typically, September does have more volatility. October is actually one of the highest, most volatile months. I think it's about 35, 36% higher on a vol perspective than the typical average of the other 11 months. But let's rewind just a week ago, Monday. And it's been a roller coaster ever since, you know, we saw the Evergrande. That was the Chinese real estate developer, had a liquidity crisis. You know, that sent stocks skidding last Monday. You know, that's pretty much a global route. But then we had a great recovery and a pretty acute recovery in the wake of the FOMC meeting. And then sure enough, we are seeing rates move higher, to your point, the 10-year note, where, you know, I spent a lot of time trading in the pits, in the futures pit, the Chicago Board of Trade CME Group. Back in the late 90s, early 2000s. But once you see that sensitivity, and it's not about the 10-year rate. I mean, let's take a big, deep breath here, because at 1.53, these are still really, really low interest rates. Right. However, to your point, it's the velocity of the move. That velocity of the move certainly is putting some selling pressure on technology, which, as long as, in my mind, if we see the 10-year interest rates say under 2%, that still bodes very well for the technology sector. However, it's these short-term movements, to your point, the noise, that's what we have to really digest and get through, because we're a couple of weeks away still from this earnings season, which I think is the most critical earnings season. But right now, you're right, there's a lot of noise. We're going into month end. We got two more trading days after today. And I actually think we see a little bit of window dressing in some of this $4.6 trillion worth of cash, which is sitting on the sideline. I think it gets put to work over the course today.
Interesting. Right. I was going to ask you, because last week, obviously, again, Monday, big down open, down day. And then by the end of the week, all those losses had been recouped and then some. But we're starting this week in a similar fashion. And oh, by the way, you mentioned Evergrande. There's also the U.S. debt ceiling showdown. You know, as we're talking now, Janet Yellen and Jay Powell are testifying before Congress. In her prepared testimony, or in a letter she sent to Congress, Janet Yellen said October 18th is the real date when, quote, Treasury is likely to exhaust its extraordinary measures if Congress has not acted to raise or suspend the debt limit. It is uncertain whether we could continue to meet all the nation's commitments after that date, end quote. How concerned are you or financial markets from your point of view with this debt ceiling showdown? Or is this just business as usual in Washington and they do this every couple of years and... But, you know, at the last minute, they're going to figure out a way to resolve it.
Certainly dysfunction in D.C., Congress chaos, whatever we want to term what's going on right now. And we've always expected some drama here. But I think this should not be a distraction in the overall market, the overarching theme, which I think we're going to press through. But yeah, you're right. Congress has got to pass a new budget by Thursday to avoid a shutdown. And it seems like every time there's a shutdown, it's just wonderful because everyone gets to talk about how we're going to go over the cliff. And it's just never happened where we've actually defaulted on our payment. We're not Evergrande. This is the U.S. Treasury. And I know our balance sheet is a little bit larger, but bigger picture, it's a distraction, and distractions make people nervous. And you're seeing a little jump in volatility. The VIX, you know, up about around 23 in the front month futures. You know, that's a pretty substantial move today, about 14-15%. But I keep on going back to the but, Aaron. We go back to the fact that we're not seeing a 30 or 40 or 50 reading on the VIX. So
right.
What the VIX really surmises is the fact that people aren't that overly concerned, because whenever you see a VIX of 16, that's typically indicating a plus or minus 1% move over the next 30 days. So if the VIX is up at 32, we're anticipating an implied vol move of 2%. We are incurring a more than a 2% move, a realized volatility move in the NASDAQ, and the VIX is still pretty subdued. So I think this Congress chaos, to your point, we're going to get through it. And we're going to get back on the fact of what actually is the Fed going to do? Will they start tapering in November, December? And I think with all the uncertainty, you know, we're still digesting the Delta variant. And that's going to be really telling, I think, in the earnings reports coming up. What did the Delta actually do globally?
Right. And I know Steve wants to jump in here. And we talked about the debt ceiling a couple of weeks ago, he and I, and I just feel compelled to say, given what we've seen in the last couple of years, I'm not convinced it's business as usual in Washington. Let's hope for sure. But I wouldn't be shocked if they drove us over the cliff, literally and figuratively, just because the politics is so dysfunctional right now from both parties for different reasons.
We got to see who's still standing there, Aaron, right? And I know Stephen's going to weigh on this, but there's people resigning. There's a lot of people trading true, on the
from
Fed.
The Fed. Yes.
I mean, it is more chaotic than usual. I'll give you that.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just get it out there very quickly. I think what's going on in D.C. is utter theater. We'll have very, very little bearing in anything but the most shortest of timeframes. But what is not theater is surging energy prices. What's not theater is shortages in the U.K. What's not theater are empty shelves, you know, whether in the U.K. or here in the U.S. What's not theater is ships not being able to unload their stuff or even leave China. You mentioned the Q3 earnings season as super important, but Q4 is super important for a lot of folks too, the retailers. If you go through their transcripts, a lot of them are worried about shipping costs. They're worried about getting product on the shelves. All these things together are not good for consumer confidence. We've seen those numbers are now steadily going down every month now, and they're not going to be good for corporate profits. So it's possible, you know, what's going on in the markets is that they're focused on that and not the histrionics in D.C.
No, that's a great point, Stephen. I think last week kind of revealed the look at the Nike earnings. Nike really fortified our fear and concern over supply chain issues. And, you know, you've seen a pretty big downdraft in Nike. It's been a laggard all year, only up about 5%, but we've seen about 10% of, you know, that performance really be shaved ever since they really, really cemented the fact that these supply chain issues, which goes back to March of 2020, the original COVID. I don't know if we're denoting original COVID, Delta. I don't know where we are in the jargon here and what's politically correct, but the original COVID of March of 2020, we're still working through those supply chain issues. And to your point, this tangible inflation, I'm sitting here in Chicago and I know the Fed doesn't utilize food and energy. And Aaron, you know me a long time. Clearly, I like to eat a lot of food. And I like to drive my vehicles. But here we are with tangible inflation. And it is a concern. I just don't know if that concern is going to really impact the markets in Q4. That's more of a 2023 story, in my opinion.
Well, that brings 2023 or 2022?
Late 2022, early 2023 okay. Is, I think, when the Fed has to react to the inflation components. Right now, they've moved the goalposts, right? They essentially have a cost average metric now on how they're measuring inflation, which allows them to have coverage and letting it run hotter. So I think that reaction is late 2022, early 2023.
Interesting. Yeah, that obviously leads us back to the Fed. As I mentioned, Jay Powell is testifying as we're speaking right here Tuesday afternoon. And in his prepared testimony, he said, quote, the effects have been larger and longer lasting than anticipated, but they will abate. And as they do, inflation is expected to drop back towards our long run 2% goal. He also added, as reopening continues, bottlenecks, hiring difficulties, and other constraints could again prove to be greater and more enduring than anticipated, posing upside risks to inflation. So basically what he's saying there is it's still transitory, but less transitory than we thought it was, but we're still going to be okay here. I mean, how do you interpret the Fed's comments here, or the chairman's comments? Excuse me.
I interpret that as a fact that, yeah, there's inflation, but we don't really care right now. We still have our dual mandate in place. There's more job openings than currently, you know, unemployed, which is problematic for them. But I think it does give them a lot of coverage. And if you think about it, you know, let's rewind to last spring. We were absolutely certain that June FOMC meeting was going to set the stage for the September taper. You know, on CNBC, right. We talked about the September taper all the time. And sure enough, we're closing out the month of September. It doesn't even look like they're going to start tapering before November, December due to the uncertainty. It's almost like it was orchestrated, the Evergrande, which wasn't really a newsflash, but it was almost like it was orchestrated to hit the markets 1-2 days before the Fed's meeting of September, which continues to give them dovish coverage.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And one other thing we didn't mention is the resignation of two Fed bank presidents yesterday, one for, quote, health reasons. But we know they got out because of they were heavy trader of things that they were influencing in. And that's touched Powell as well. He owns some of the securities that the Fed bought. So whatever I want to say bad about Powell, the fact is he appears to have done a fairly good job after his early stumbles. And I think there's the risk that Powell does not get renominated. I don't think he's going to resign the way they did. I think that would be too upsetting for the markets. But I think there's a risk that he will not be renominated, and that kind of the risk of the unknown of who might take his place might be an issue as well.
Well, Stephen, I don't think Fed Chairman Powell was scalping S&P futures like some of the other his colleagues were during actual meetings. That's a joke, folks. That's a joke. But there was a lot of trading, short and long in the S&P 500, which really kind of makes you scratch your head on how are these public officials allowed to trade. But that's a whole other show, right, Aaron? But I think Fed Chairman Powell has really articulated, and this goes back to, look at March 23rd of 2020. He articulated the markets that the Federal Reserve will be supporting the markets in perpetuity in unlimited capacity. And that's exactly what they've done, right? I mean, everyone tries to second guess, are they going to be hawkish this time? No, he continues to be quite overt that he's very dovish, very accommodative. And now here we are 18 months into this emergency purchases of $120 billion a month. It's pushed the Fed's balance sheet above $8.5 trillion, which is just a staggering stat. We're going to be knocking at $9 trillion and go over $9 trillion before this taper really comes into effect. And the taper itself, I think we got to just unpack that a little bit. Tapering is not a bad word. Tapering just means they're buying less of the $120 billion right. per month, but they're not unwinding their balance sheet. That's where I don't know if the Fed can ever unwind their balance sheet. And that's where I continue to be constructive and optimistic when you do see all this noise.
Interesting. So I'm glad you said that, because you referenced that earlier, some of the money coming off the sideline. So, short story, are you a buyer here of equities, generally speaking? And can you be more specific than that?
Yeah, we're buying some subsectors today. We're looking at cybersecurity. We're looking at semiconductors. Some of these really, we're seeing a lot of emotion. Look at NVIDIA today, down over 4%. There's some of the names that we already had positions to, we're adding. We look at some of our sector rotation, which still highlights the fact we want to own technology, but we're also being very mindful of the rotation trade, the reflation trade. And that's been something, I almost have like deja vu. I was talking to our investment committee yesterday. And if you remember last fall, when you saw that selling pressure occur in technology, and that's when the reflation trade really came on. But you look at names that, kind of are laggards on the year, if it's a 3M, it's a Johnson & Johnson, a Boeing, a Masco, a Lockheed Martin. Those are names that we have in our Essential 40 portfolio. Those are tangible blue chip names. Think Peter Lynch back in the 80s, of buy what you know. These names are more buy what you use. So that's why we think owning some of these is going to be a very similar type of rotation we saw last fall. And that makes a lot of sense as people are really getting nervous about interest rates. I'm not in the camp, guys, that interest rates are going to go up to 2%. I think there's a limit at 170. And that's why I think the 10-year, and I've been in a pretty lonely view all year. I've said it, in January on CNBC, and I continue to say it, but I think the 10-year note is tethered to 1.5%. I think the Fed wants that. And whatever the Fed wants, seemingly, they've been getting
it. Right. So you mentioned the reflation trade. The cruise lines and the airlines have been doing well, in this recent past, last few days or weeks. Is that telling us anything, or is it, again, just a rotation out of what's been working into what hasn't been working? Because there's so much money out there, it's got to find a home.
Well, I think it's telling us a couple of things. One, I think there was an overreaction to potentially the damage that the Delta variant was doing to those specific airlines. I own Delta Airlines. I sold American Airlines too soon. But Delta, and United, you're seeing a little bit of pickup here. And I think that's kind of forecasting that maybe that the Delta wasn't impactful domestically as we thought. However, you know, I think this rotation trade, I think it's still in its early, early stages. And that's the overarching theme that value has been on sale for quite some time. We've seen growth really take over the last couple of years, specifically the market cap weighted S&P 500 index, where you see such a concentration in the FANG stocks. And we still want to own the FANG stocks. However, you look at Google up 61% year to date. You look at Oracle, you look at Microsoft, some of these names, which, you know, are up 30, 40, 50%. It's time to, you know, reconsider your exposure or rebalance your exposure and take some profits. I know everyone waits till December to tax loss harvest, but there's no tax loss harvesting this year. The market's up again.
Right, right. And I think Oracle hit an all-time high today, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Oracle's been a name we actually put into the portfolio this year. We were excited about their trajectory. You know, you look at it's only a market cap of $251 billion. So it's almost like laughable when you put it next to a Microsoft or an Amazon. Wow. But this is, you know, it's one of the best in the business. We think it's essential. And yeah, we're seeing it up another 1% today in the face of some pretty tough tape.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Alpha Trader.
Okay, we're back with Alpha Trader, Stephen Alfer and Aaron Task, along with Jeff Kilburg. As we were speaking, Senator Elizabeth Warren is talking at the Powell hearing, and she says she calls Powell a dangerous man and she will oppose renomination. And renominating Powell is not a risk worth taking. Now, I don't have the context around those comments. That's just kind of like the headline over the Bloomberg. I think the first arrow against him is kind of out there, and I'd be interested to see if that spreads. But back to kind of stock picking, the hottest sector this year from an extremely low base, of course, has been energy, and it's up today as the broader market is down, as oil hits new multi-year highs and natural gas goes through the roof. Are you bullish on continuing gains for energy?
So we actually have a tactical model, and we booked profits middle of September on energy. It's been a great run. We still own Exxon from a single stock security perspective, but we've had exposure. You know, if you look at, you know, some of the different ETFs that give you exposure, like IEO, that's the U.S. oil and gas exploration product. Mm-hmm. Like those are all names that you guys know: ConocoPhillips, Marathon, Hess, Valero. So I think having broad swath exposure makes sense. But right now, we did see a little bit of a pullback from a relative strength, despite the fact that it's ripping. You know, still as we close out the month of September, but pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered, and I think energy's been a great run. But let's remember how brutal energy was a year ago, and a lot of folks had to endure that. So hopefully they're more than back to even. If you look at Occidental and some of these names, which, you know, it was pretty rough sledding in 2020.
Yeah, it sure was. Well, while we're on this topic of energy, so first of all, I want to go back to Warren's comments about Powell at some point before we close out the show. So Stephen, remind me if I forget. But while we're on topic of energy, you could argue maybe this, you know, there's so many, what's the biggest story? This could be the biggest story of what's happening. Jeff Query, head of commodities research at Goldman, was quoted as saying, "We look at rig counts in the U.S. and other parts of the world. They're showing you that, hey, $80 a barrel, and that's for Brent, is simply not enough." I'm also seeing a lot of speculation out there that with natural gas prices surging in Europe and Asia, the power plants might go back to oil as fuel, and then we could see $100 oil. Do you see, you know, how bullish is this the pigs getting slaughtered scenario, or do you think that we're at risk of this surge in energy prices continuing as we head towards winter?
I think we're at risk of energy prices continuing to surge. I talked to a lot of traders, and they envision that a triple digit, you know, WTI futures price is not, you know, out of the question. I don't see $100 crude anytime soon in Q4. But yeah, those different pieces of the puzzle that could come together, that could push and elevate. But I think it's more about how, you know, Asia really recovers. You know, there are just different components of the lockdown. That the Delta variant was very different. It was handled very differently, I think, in Asia. And we're really trying to assess and measure the demand coming out of China specifically to help us better understand where, you know, those oil prices are going, as they're such a large consumer. But again, anything coming out of China, we have a hard time measuring, as you know.
Right, right. And so how are you, or how would you be positioned for higher energy prices from here? Because it sounded like you were saying maybe these energy stocks are, you know,
tactically
run.
Yeah, tactically, we closed our position in some of the ETFs that we like the broad swath exposure. However, we still own ExxonMobil. In some of our portfolios, we like to write options, covered call strategy. We're not writing any covered calls on Exxon. We're letting it have a long leash here before we even consider that, because a lot of those covered call strategies have a hard time dealing with acute moves higher. But ExxonMobil is the best in the business. That's the essential name, we believe. Chevron, of course, is having a day. So we don't mind owning Chevron, but we do own Exxon.
And okay, I always like to ask the Chicago traders about the dollar, exactly. Guys who've been on the floor before, because while we're focused on everything else, the floor traders always had to have an eye on what the dollar was doing.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely. So
it's the dollar's had a big September alongside a downdraft in stocks. Would you look at the dollar to kind of as a leading indicator? If that were to turn lower, would that make you bullish, or do you think you may not get that signal? That's just going to kind of move coincidentally.
We'll look at the dollar trade 93.72 right now. I think it's still in a range, and you're absolutely right. That is a guiding light, a beacon, if you will, to help us better understand where energy is going and where emerging is going, where international is going. And I'm in the camp that we're going to continue to see the U.S. dollar index have a hard time getting above 94, 95. And that bodes well for commodities, but also bodes well for emerging international. And I think that's a function of the fact that the Federal Reserve really can't allow the dollar index to go too much higher. I mean, we're in a currency war. No one wants to really talk about, but you know, it's a currency war. We've been in with all the central bankers for quite some time. So the ECB, the PBOC, the Bank of Japan, they're all kind of looking to us, but we've been pretty static, and it's been a trader's delight, you know, being stuck in this range in the dollar index. But I don't think the dollar index is going to, you know, see a big move higher. That would be detrimental, not just to commodities and crude oil, but that would hurt the overall equity markets as well, right? Because that would be something that really isn't being forecast right now by a lot of traders.
Right. And we know the Fed doesn't want that. And if the Fed gets
Fed does what not it wants, want
that. They don't want that. But I do want to ask you, it sounds like you're not too concerned about the dollar, and you talk about the dollar index at those levels you mentioned going much higher from here. But how do you explain all these inflationary indicators? We talked about oil, natural gas, home prices. There are many more. I saw a stat the other day that lumber, which of course crashed from its spring peak, is now up 20% from its recent lows. So there's a lot of stuff, prices rising, and yet the dollar index is at its highest level, as we're talking here, since November 2020. How do you square that circle?
I don't know if you actually do, to be honest with you, Aaron. Inflation is here. You know, it's not transitory. And, you know, if you look at some of the home builders and some of the supplies, to your point, I mean, you know, home builders is the number one subsector right now on our tactical model, continues to reveal a lot of relative strength. And that RSI index, you know, certainly gets a little bit concerning. But with the rates where they are, even at 150, you know, that still encourages people to move out of these tier one cities due to COVID. And I think the whole experience, right? The whole experience, if you live in Chicago, downtown, New York, Manhattan, like that whole experience has changed if you're a young family or anyone. So I think this home building theme continues to persist. That's where the demand is. But how do I square out the inflation? I don't know if I have that answer, because I incur inflation in every day of my life.
Right. I would expect the dollar to be weaker in the face of that, and not stronger.
I think it's range bound. And I think this range bound, okay, you know, we have to rewind a couple of years when we saw the dollar at par, even up to 103, you know, just a couple of years ago. So now we're in this subdued lower range. It's okay if you have higher highs and higher lows, but as long as it stays kind of sideways in this range, that's the velocity. And I keep on going back to the velocity, and that's the trader, you know, all the years I spent trading in the pits speaking loudly, but the velocity is so important in all these equations. If it's talking about emerging, if it's talking about the US dollar index, talking about the treasury or interest rates, this velocity, less velocity is better, and less velocity creates more tranquility. And that's what the Fed wants. They get really kind of spooked when you see, you know, look last Wednesday, to your point you talked about earlier in the show, the 10-year note was trading 131. You see a 20 basis point move. When I was trading in, you know, the 10 years back in the early 2000s, the 10-year was at 5.25. So a 20 basis point move was not that big a deal. A 20 basis point move on a 130 10-year, that's a big deal.
Yep. It's a big deal. And in my, you know, going back further, like, you know, a 2 basis point move was a big deal.
That's, you
know,
right.
20 years ago, it just didn't move that much.
That's right.
So this is different. Interesting. And so speaking of velocity of things, I mentioned earlier, U.S. home prices, this is the Case-Shiller index, up 19.7% in July. It's the biggest jump in more than 30 years. The 20 city index gained 19.9%. Phoenix led the way, but you have New York, Boston, Dallas, Seattle, and Denver all posted record year-over-year increases. So you just said you like the home builders. Does any of this strike you as getting too frothy? I mean, how long can this kind of activity continue?
I think it lasts longer. That's because I'm in the camp of lower interest rates for longer. And I think, you know, yeah, you're seeing obviously the home builders beat up today. You know, D.R. Horton's down almost 3%. Lennar's down 3%. But this has been a pretty good run. And if you utilize ITB, that's the U.S. home construction ETF, gives you a nice broad swath exposure, it's still up about 25% year to date. And I think, to your point, I don't feel like we're dancing between the raindrops yet. But nonetheless, it has been a heck of a move higher for all these, you know, builders. If it's Masco, if it's Sherwin-Williams, you know, it's KB Home. A lot of them have really enjoyed this. But I think there's still more room to run because there's just not a lot of inventory and they can't build the homes fast enough in some of these suburbs of tier one and tier two cities.
Right, right. And first of all, so dancing between the raindrops, I think that should be the headline of this podcast.
Yeah, I love it.
Also, just to be clear, so you're CIO of Sanctuary Wealth.
Yes.
How are you positioned vis-a-vis the home builders currently? I just want to be clear because I'm not sure I caught it.
So in our tactical model, which is a relative strength weekly type of screening, we look to see which sectors are revealing strength and which sectors are revealing weakness. And right now, we're seeing a lot of strength in the home builders. We're also seeing strength in regional banks and semiconductors. So those are just, I can't give you all the secret sauce here, Aaron. You
have to be
a client at some point here, my man. But those are, you know, three of the eight sectors that we have positions to. And again, dancing between the raindrops, we're just trying to find a way. We're seeking alpha. That's another catchphrase for it, which I know you love. We're seeking alpha in a way, in a manner that we can obviously stick with sectors and subsectors revealing strength, but staying the heck away from sectors revealing weakness. So like in 2020, we did not own any energy exposure until late Q3, early Q4. So this is an active and dynamic approach. And this is just one of many models. You know, we run a variety of different models in SMA formats for the folks at Sanctuary and our advisors. We also have single stock security sleeves. We also have ESG. We have a variety, but this specific tactical model is active, is dynamic. And when you look at some, I'll give you one more here because you know I like you, Aaron, but we also have industrial exposure and you've seen that ramp up and that really plays into the rotation trade, which we feel confidence in.
Right. And it would speak to, I would think, the reopening and that we're not heading towards some sort of major slowdown in the economy. You know, I know there's concerns about that too, given some of the recent weakness we've seen in China, particularly.
Right. And sentiment has been skeptical. I know your buddy over at Morgan Stanley, Mike Wilson, has been, you know, I don't know if he's been short like some of the Federal Reserve traders, but I know that he's been skeptical of the market in the last 10, 15% move higher. But I think that sentiment is being, you know, overtaken by a lot of the technicals. And technically, it seems like this move higher is going to stay in place. And I'll be really interested to see how we close, not only today, but close the month to set the stage for Q4. But I'm optimistic going into Q4. And there are headwinds, there are alarms, there are reasons that I can be skeptical. But I go back to Uncle Jerome Powell with the wheel firmly in his hand and $4.6 trillion in cash on the sideline.
Yep. And just a reminder to our listeners and myself, really, the fourth quarter starts Friday, right? It's, you know, and also on the sentiment front, Bank of America out today with their survey, they show inflows were the fourth largest in our data history since 08 and the largest since December as a percentage of S&P market cap. Quote, clients were big net buyers of U.S. equities last week. Buy the dip mentality underscores optimistic sentiment. So I know there's so many ways to measure sentiment and we're always, I think, more attuned to the world, the sky is falling type of stuff. But what is your read? How do you gauge market sentiment here?
Well, if we're going to look at a chart of Bank of America, yeah, it does scream a little frothy. I'd like to tilt it towards more JP Morgan, but Bank of America trading about $43 Oh my goodness. You know,
that was BofA research. I mean, that's not the,
I know. But I like looking at things, I look at things in tickers. And when you talk about 06, 07, when it was trading above $50, and then, I don't think it went negative. I don't think stocks can not go negative, but Bank of America tried to go negative, right? But back here at $43, I think it just underscores the fact that the shape of the curve is moving, that banks have been in favor, in the last couple quarters here, and they're finding a way to be nimble, and they're finding to be up, to be profit centers. And it'll be interesting to see how the banks, which typically always kick off earnings season the next couple of weeks, I want to understand their profitability in trading, because there has been trading opportunities. The equity markets have kind of grinded higher, not a lot of pullbacks, obviously, but the fixed income has been tradable. So I'll be interested to see. And the banks, for a couple of years ago, they were kind of the backbone in the rally. And then they kind of went to the wayside when we saw all the massive intervention, and obviously banks were just tough to own after COVID hit marketplace. But I think Bank of America, as well as some of these other big banks, are going to continue to move higher as we can continue to see this slow move higher in rates, which should bode well for them. But they've also become more dynamic in their trading. So that's the bottom line. And they are providing some leadership right now.
All right. Well, so that was an answer to a question I didn't ask, but I appreciate it because it's great to get your views on the financials. So before we wrap, let's bring it back to the breaking news as we were doing this podcast that Stephen mentioned earlier. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Tuesday on Capitol Hill, said, quote, Powell is a dangerous man. I oppose renomination. We also referenced earlier the recent resignation of two Fed presidents, regional Fed presidents. You have the dysfunction over the debt ceiling going on. And a couple of weeks ago, Stephen and I were talking about some of the commentary coming out of China over regulations and their crackdown on that week. It was the casinos. And he made what I thought was a really great point is like the way we view stuff out of China is very different than maybe what's really going on in China. But if you look from the outside, America, we probably don't seem as competent as we used to. Is that at all a factor into your thinking here? Or are those the raindrops that you're talking about? Is that just noise?
No, it's more noise than usual, to your point. Senator Warren, she's not afraid of the microphone. We know that. But to say that she has grave concerns about, his support for loosening financial rules, I don't think she really falls on the side of capitalism. But I try not to get political here. I try to stay just, market forecasting. Same. But I think this is just more of the same. And I think, America, no matter if you're on the left or the right or in the middle or wherever you may lie, I think we're just so done with the drama and, the chaos we see continually out of D.C. So, you can't pick one administration to blame. I think it's just a blend of all these administrations and people who, are continually not accomplishing goals that we need for America. So I don't have the solution. I'm never going to be running for president, but nonetheless, I think we just have to endure more Elizabeth Warren comments. And they seem to kind of, see who can make the most outlandish and who can get their, face on the paper. I mean, you remember, Aaron, back in the day, we didn't even know who the Fed presidents were. We
right.
had no idea. We didn't even know who the Fed chairperson was back in the 80s or 90s. And now
we didn't know what the Fed funds rate was. We didn't know what the Fed funds rate was back then. It's crazy.
But now they're rock stars and, Bullard, that guy loves a camera, right? So to see people, making opinions and that just creates a lot of noise. But I think the market, the tape has gotten somewhat accustomed to the noise. But today's rhetoric certainly is impacting sentiment without a doubt.
Right. And also, I should note, Sherrod Brown of Ohio at some point today, Tuesday, also introduced legislation or said he's going to introduce legislation that would prevent Fed officials from trading at all, I guess. But nothing for Congress, nothing for members of Congress. It's still okay for them to trade. So
isn't that remarkable in itself? I mean, this goes back decades and decades. How they're able to have the intel. I mean, you want to talk about inside information.
Yeah, then they can't be. They're not. It's impossible for them to insider trade. Isn't that sort of how the legislation is written? Like they can do anything basically because they're.
And look, this is a blanket statement. This is a blanket statement, which we don't love, but majority of Congress typically have second and third homes. And there's I'm not saying everyone is trading, but nonetheless, that should have been abolished decades ago. And the fact that it's just coming up in 2021 is kind of a travesty.
Well, I saw a classic the other day. It was a picture of Nancy Pelosi and George Soros together. And the caption was, one of these people, one of these persons is the greatest trader ever. The other one is George Soros. So, but I think the bottom line out of everything we're talking about is a Fed that's going to be, not that they need the help, but it's a Fed that's going to be easier monetary wise than they otherwise would be, because they're going to want to appease.
Yeah, I think
the administration, they're going to want to appease members of Congress.
Yeah, Stephen, you bring up a great point. And yes, a lot of the noise that we're, you know, going to have to live through this next quarter, I think it goes back to the fact the overarching theme, and this is why I remain constructive and optimistic on equities, is because Fed Chairman Powell will remain dovish, accommodative, and he's not going to make a mistake on the hawkish side. He may make a mistake, and let inflation run too hot, but that's a mistake that he's willing to risk because of this uncertainty. And I think he continues to try and use the previous measuring sticks that we used to use before pre-crisis. And those measuring sticks are just not applicable. So we're in a new normal, with a balance sheet of nearly $9 trillion. If that balance sheet gets reduced from $9 trillion to $5 trillion, yes, then you're going to see us get really defensive. But as of right now, I think Fed Chairman Powell, just like the COVID guy who hung a sign every day. Remember the sign guy every day?
Yeah.
I think Fed Chairman Powell is hanging the sign right now that says risk on.
Right.
Risk on. All right. Well, yeah. It's a risk off day as we're talking here. And I appreciate the optimism. It's refreshing given the red I'm seeing on the screens here. I did want to ask before we let you go what your view is, broadly speaking, on cryptocurrencies, which are also falling today. To me, they are, short story, still just a risk asset. And they're not a hedge. They haven't worked if that's what you're using them for. But that's enough of what I think. What's your take?
Yeah, you bring up a great point. I mean, the safe haven trade or the way people like to talk about Bitcoin has replaced gold. I don't think that's truly applicable yet. However, Bitcoin is still above 40,000. So you are seeing the broader adoption of cryptocurrency. I think you're seeing more and more younger traders flock to trading, if it's Ethereum or Tether or whatever they're trying to trade. So I'm a big believer in blockchain. I do have cryptocurrency exposure, not significant enough to matter. But nonetheless, I think this is important to understand. And I actually like owning companies that have Bitcoin exposure. So I think that's a safer way to potentially approach the sector. But if you have the ability to stomach some additional beta, I think you have the ability to get rewarded. So, I'm not saying run out and buy as much Bitcoin as you can right here at 41,000, but I think you should have some exposure to blockchain and Bitcoin in your portfolio, either through publicly traded companies or directly in the cryptos.
So I have to ask, is that, do you own Coinbase? Do you own MicroStrategy? Are there other companies with the direct exposure you're talking about?
You're just looking for all the answers right now,
Mike. I am, of course. I mean, the people who've stayed this long in this podcast deserve to know.
Jeff. Yeah, that's right. I do like specific names like Square, like MicroStrategy, but we also like, the BLCN, that is an ETF that gets you exposure to Coinbase, Accenture, Square, AMD. You look at PayPal, there's a more broad swath exposure versus just picking MicroStrategy, which truly is a proxy to Bitcoin. So I think you have the ability to look at a couple different single stocks, but also I like ETFs. I'm a big believer in diversification. You know that.
Yep. All right. Well, that's, a nice reward for the folks who stuck it out to the end to get that.
No doubt.
Thank you for recommendation. Thanks for sticking around. Thanks as always for tuning in. And thanks much to our guest today. Jeff Kilberg is the Chief Investment Officer of Sanctuary Wealth and the founder and CEO of KKM Financial. Jeff, continued success in dancing between the raindrops. Thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me, fellas.
Thank you, Jeff.